In our proceedings this morning, I just want to extend our gratitude on behalf of the panel to this law school, and we're thrilled to be here, and we really appreciate all the courtesies that have been extended to us. So, thank you. First case this morning is 16-1208, Affinity Labs versus Samsung Electronics. Mr. Schultz, whenever you're ready. We're ready. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, or afternoons if you have not adjusted to the California time zone. This case is a prime example of a results-driven decision by the PTAB, which is demonstrated by the fact that the evidence on two key issues is not sufficient that a reasonable mind would accept the conclusions that the PTAB reached in this case. The first issue that I would like to discuss relates to the claim element of a cellular telephone. Now, the construction that was adopted in this case and agreed upon by the parties is that a cellular telephone was a telephone with access to a cellular radio system so that it could be used over a wide area without a physical connection to the network.
Just to start off, just to be clear, we're not dealing with a de novo review of claim construction here. We've got a substantial evidence review of what the board did, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. So when looking at the evidence related to whether or not the reference, the Trey's reference, disclosed this claim element, the board relied on various disparate statements within that reference to arrive at its conclusion that Trey's discloses a cellular telephone. And I believe that this is highlighted by the one statement in the final decision that has been reiterated by the petitioners here to this courtroom, or to this court. And that statement is, Trey's
Where are you reading from?
Sure, Your Honor. It is A7 in the addendum, or page 34 on petitioner's brief. There's a statement in there where the board finds Trey's has built-in telephone functions permitting the device to place and receive calls using cellular telephone transmissions. Now, first of all, this is not a direct quote from Trey's. That disclosure, that conclusion is not in Trey's. What that is a Frankenstein hodgepodge collection of citations in Trey's to arrive at that conclusion. And in fact, if we look, the board cites four different sections within Trey's in support of this conclusion. But none of those sections claim or describe a cellular telephone, much less a phone that can make and use calls over cellular transmissions. There is simply no citation or disclosure.
Well, am I wrong? I mean, just in Trey's, I have notes here from Trey's, and it states several times that its device may include telephone capabilities. And it says it can send and receive cellular telephone transmissions and can include a telephone headset. That's a citation. Those are citations from Trey's, not from the board's opinion or conclusions with respect to what Trey's said, but what Trey's actually said. Why is that not sufficient under substantial evidence review to affirm on this question?
Because, Your Honor, that those separate sections within Trey's don't make the link to a cellular telephone that can make and receive calls over a cellular network. When it talks about built-in telephone functions, it's talking about using a landline, a normal handset telephone, and all of the references within Trey's. And in fact, if you look at figure 10A, it shows that when it's talking about a phone and having telephone capabilities, it's talking about a telephone, a landline phone that you would have plugged into a phone jack. And in fact, again, if you look at the devices that Trey's himself is describing are included in his disclosure, which is found in column 1, lines 29 through 30, he describes the type of audio devices here as alarm clocks, clock radios, radios. And I believe in column 8, there's a further description where additional devices where he talks about stereos are included, personal computers. Again, nowhere in here does Trey say there is a cellular telephone. And when it talks about cellular telephone transmissions, it's clear it's talking about data transmissions. The one site I would point you to is in column 2, lines 22 through 35, where Trey's that the board relies on where it identifies cellular telephone transmission, but if you continue through the list that is provided in trays, it says any other suitable type of data transmission. It's not talking about making phone calls. It's talking about using cellular telephone transmissions to transmit data or audio signals to these devices, not the conclusion that the board reached of make and receive phone calls. And there's nowhere in trays within even that list of permutations. I mean, that in column two here, there are six different ways of data transmission. Nothing in trays says, well, in particular, cellular telephone transmissions is the more preferred way or is the way to do this. So now you have to take various disparate statements within trays and then combine them together. But trays has no disclosure within itself to say combine these into a cellular telephone. So that was the first error that the board made. The second error, then, relates to the other evidence submitted by petitioners on this issue, which is simply Dr. Quackenbush's declaration. And if you look at A328, which is the paragraph related to this issue in Dr. Quackenbush's declaration, he merely recites these same passages and then concludes, one of skill would understand this to disclose a cell phone. There is simply no analysis there by Dr. Quackenbush of taking these statements and then why they would arrive at the conclusion that this discloses a cellular telephone.
May I ask, did the board say anything about figure four in trays? I'm looking at page A407, which I think is trays. Figure four shows.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, it may have been in passing. It may have been incorporated into some reference to what petitioner cite.
Tell me what to make of the, if you have figure four in front of you, the box that shows user input interface, e.g. buttons, telephone, handset, and it goes through control circuitry, and then there are a variety of communication circuitry, which includes various wireless communication circuitry. Why does that not show a cell phone?
Because I don't think it's, I think it's ambiguous as to what it discloses, whether it's a cell phone or a landline. And I think if you look at the reference,
Right,
whole,
but that's why I mentioned the wireless communication circuitry, long range, short range.
Right, and that communication circuitry, again, is all related to data transmission. There's nothing in there about making and receiving telephone calls. Because, again, the device in trays is really trying to, and you can see it in column one where it says the purpose of, or the goal of its invention is to provide audio devices that handle audio signals other than traditional radio broadcasts. So, again, what trays is trying to describe is this type of device that would sit on your nightstand that, other than just your typical alarm clock receiving FM signals or AM radio signals, it could receive audio signals through other transmissions such as internet connections and whatnot. And I think the figure four merely illustrates, again, that the only use of any short, you know, what they describe as short-range wireless communication was for data and not make-receive phone calls, which is fundamental and critical for the analysis because it's got to be a telephone. The other issue I would like to just briefly...
Can I double-check again? I'm sorry if I don't remember something I should remember. The claim construction of cellular phone is or is not a telephone with access to a cellular radio system so it can be used over a wide area without a physical connection to a network. And is telephone further defined?
No, Your Honor.
So where is the requirement that I think you keep pressing that data transmission is not sufficient?
Well, in order to be a telephone, it has to make and receive calls. So the issue of whether or not it can receive data is not critical to the determination of whether there is a telephone that can connect to a cellular radio system to be used over a wide area without a physical connection to a network. So that would include.
So you think the fundamental definition of telephone is that it makes and receives calls?
I'm unaware of any other definition that would.
Well, so if trays uses telephone, doesn't that mean it also makes and receives calls?
It can make and receive calls in telephone, but again, telephone has been modified here in this construction to have additional limitations of how that telephone is to be used, where it has to be able to be used in a wide area without a physical network connection. So your landline phone...
Right, but we're not talking about that now. We're talking about whether Trays discloses a telephone, and Figure 4 seems to explicitly disclose a telephone handset. And if you agree that telephone, by definition, includes the ability to make and receive calls, I don't understand how this Figure 4 doesn't, by your definition, include a telephone.
Well, because, again, the term that we are working here is cellular telephone. That's the claim term that's been defined to have a telephone with these additional limitations.
Okay, so if we assume then that this discloses a telephone and then move on to the question of the whether this discloses cellular, why wouldn't we read long-range wireless communication circuitry as a cell communication?
Because you're not making a telephone call over that long-range network.
You're kind of running in circles here, though. You suggested that the definition of telephone itself means you can make and receive calls. There's a telephone here. And then we need to decide if there's a cellular component, which seems to be supplied by long-range wireless communications.
Well, and I think the problem, Your Honor, is that they're not two different components. It is all one. And so this device the cellular phone as defined has to be a telephone that can access and be used over wide area without a physical network connection. And the disclosure in Figure 4 of Trays, again, is not talking about utilizing those components in Box 68 for the normal functionality of telephones.
How do we know that? I mean, it's connected by lines to the long-range wireless communications, and then it's connected by another line to audio output. Why isn't that read as cell phone system connecting through a telephone to an audio output?
Because when you read the full disclosure of Trays, when it talks about telephone functionality, it's talking about through a landline connection. And when it's talking about cellular telephone transmissions, it's only talking about data transmissions. There's no disclosure in Trays that says this is related to making and be able to use make phone calls over a cellular network. So in the little time remaining, I would like to just shift another issue is related to the element of data rate, the data switching of the data communication rate. And there the board makes two fundamental errors. First, it says Fuller simply discloses the general idea of doing data transmission rate, and that's sufficient. That turns KSR on its head. KSR says it has to be a known method used in a known way to achieve predictable results. It is not just simply the general idea of data switching is therefore the known method. KSR, again, establishes that it has to be well-known routine functions or methods that are used and implemented in the combination, not just general ideas. Taking that logic to its end, you would say that the script for Star Wars discloses the general idea of light speed travel. And thus, in the future, when somebody actually comes up with the method of it, it would be rendered obvious because there was a disclosure in the 70s of the general idea of light-speed travel. That is just, matter of law, an error, and should is reversible. Second issue related to that is then the idea of if Fuller is limited to the Java applet mechanism for doing the data transmission, there's not sufficient evidence that a reasonable mind would accept the board's conclusion. In particular, if you look at paragraph 43 of Dr. Quackenbush's declaration in the petition, which is A673, he merely concludes that there would have been an expectation of success. If you look at the evidence that was submitted to the petition, he has several paragraphs preceding it that illustrate the motivation to combine, but don't get to the reasonable expectation of success. That is simply a conclusion, and this court has found that that does not meet the substantial evidence standard. But even if we look at the evidence that then petitioners set forth in their reply brief, which was new evidence, they rely on this idea of using personal Java to execute the Java applet in Fuller. And then board relied on A17, this reference that identified four types of devices that could use personal Java. And those were handheld PCs, set-top internet boxes, web phones, and game controllers. Now, I don't believe Petitioner's Counsel is going to get up here and say game controllers or set-top internet boxes are the cellular phones that they're proposing in this combination. So then the question is handheld PCs or web phones fall within that? Well, a handheld PC, by its very nature, is not a telephone. It's a handheld PC. It's a PDA. So that one doesn't work. So then you're left with web phones. And there's no evidence in the record that then analyzes and determines that the board could have relied on to say the web phones disclosed in that article are the cellular phones disclosed in Trays. There's a fundamental gap there. And because there is a gap in there, there's not sufficient evidence for the board's conclusion that there was a disclosure or an expectation of success to combine the method in Fuller with the device in Trays.
Okay. You've exceeded your rebuttal, so we'll restore 2 minutes when we hear from the other side. Thank you,
Your Honor.
May it please the court. I'd like to start with the cellular telephone issue, and just to note that the board does rely on page A10 on three different occasions on figure four.
Yes.
So it is.
But Trays is about an alarm clock, right?
I don't think that's true, Your Honor. It is a
calls
device.
Its device an alarm clock, right?
It does call it an alarm clock, but it
okay.
says
and it
that
never
it has
says
functions.
That it's a cell phone, right?
It says that it has cellular
phone. Why don't you
telephone.
Answer my question yes or no, and then you can explain it. It never says it's a cell phone. It never states that it is a cell phone.
It does not use those terms, correct?
Okay. Okay.
But what it does disclose, and this court's cases are very clear that prior art references are not limited to the exact words that they use, but what they disclose and what a person of ordinary skill would understand them to disclose. And what figure four discloses is, as I think the patent owner has conceded, a telephone. It has a telephone handset. And the patent owner claims that the telephone that's disclosed is limited to a landline. But that's not consistent with figure four or the description of figure four in column 14 of the Trays patent. Because figure four says that there's a long range wireless communications capacity. And then in column 13, the Trays discloses that includes communications with a cellular telephone system. Now, the patent owner has said that a telephone communicates, bidirectionally. They claim that it's limited to voice. I don't think that that's true of telephone. But whatever telephone means, column 13.
I'm not sure they say it's limited to voice, but that it has to include
it has
voice.
To do voice. I don't believe that that's true, but whatever telephone means, Trays uses the word telephone to describe the types of cellular communications that are going on in figure 14, which has the telephone handset. So the standard here, again, is substantial evidence. Was there substantial evidence for the board's conclusion that Trays disclosed a cellular telephone? And there's ample evidence to support that conclusion in figure 4 alone. But even beyond figure 4, the board also noted that in the same column, I think it's column 2, the Trays discloses that the device can have an answering machine to answer a call that comes in if it's not answered at that time. So again, the clear reference to the phone operating as a phone, although it's primarily described as an alarm clock, clearly it has these other capabilities, including that of serving as a telephone. And when it serves as a telephone, there are multiple disclosures, including a landline, but also a cellular telephone system.
Okay, can I ask you to switch topics for a moment? What's the best place in the board opinion that says here, as of the relevant time, is the reason and the evidence for this reason that a relevant skilled artisan would have been motivated to combine Fuller, broadly read, I'll put that, just stipulate to that for now, and Trays, again, broadly read?
Well, there are a couple of places, I would say,
not just the, we reject the assertion that it's impossible, but
no.
Here's the affirmative reason.
That's right. I would say on page 9, where they discuss what Quackenbush testified to as the motivation to combine, and then again...
I'm sorry, where on page 9? I'm sorry.
On page 9, they say... petitioner contends, and they're citing the Quackenbush Declaration here, that Fuller's method of switching, one ordinary skill in the art would have incorporated Fuller's method of switching transmission rates into trays in order to prevent the input buffer from running out of data, which would result in substantial and perceivable degradation of audio quality.
So that, that's where the board is reciting petition, your argument, I guess.
That's right.
So that's not an actual adoption by the board of it. Where does the board say, and here's what we find on the subject?
Well, they also, on page A15, find sufficient Dr. Quackenbush's analysis of the disclosures of trays and Fuller, and then specifically talking to the concept of motivation combined, including Trey's disclosure that a buffer can be used to improve the quality of streaming audio, and that he concluded, Quackenbush, that the switching of communication rates in adding that to Trey's would work and provide the expected functionality. Now, he's citing to, and then in the next paragraph continuing, they credit Dr. Quackenbush's testimony that one of ordinary skill in the art would have sought to use and would have had reasonable expectation of success in implementing Fuller's idea of switching transmission rates in trays. Now, Dr. Quackenbush put together two different things that are explicit motivations to combine in the two references. He noted that in trays, there's an express reference to buffering as one approach to solving the problem that you have of continuous transmission of data and wanting to make sure that there's always some data there for the audio. Buffering was how Trey suggested to solve that. Now, Quackenbush points to the fact that in Fuller, Fuller explicitly describes the benefit of switching rates to make sure to enhance the quality of that by making sure that you're matching the bandwidth of the client with the rate of audio coming in. So it's an enhancement of a Trey's solution to this problem that a person of ordinary skill in the art would have been motivated to apply Fuller to Trey's in exactly the way Fuller describes.
Can I shift gears again?
Yes, ma'am.
To yet another issue? And I know I understand that you're not here to necessarily defend all of the board's rules and procedures, but there's a motion to exclude here.
Yes.
And it gives, I guess I have a question about how the board chose to handle it. And my question is, when they say at the end, they kind of treat it on its merits, thus to the extent, but their final conclusion is, to the extent that the petitioner's reply evidence does not respond to specific arguments, in other words, should be excluded, or seeks to establish an element necessary to make out its case in chief, it has not been considered. So at the end of the day, we don't know what the board decided it should consider and what decided it couldn't decide.
Well,
consider, right?
I think we do know because the board does cite only a very small subset of the evidence that was submitted in connection with
but
the
But we
reply.
Have lots of cases that say when people complain to us, well, the Court of Veterans Claims didn't analyze this argument, and we say we assume there's an assumption that a tribunal considers something even if they don't deal with it or talk about it. So my question goes to how we are supposed to review, and we get to review, the PTAB's consideration of motions to exclude, and how we are supposed to be able to review the PTAB's decision when the PTAB doesn't tell us what it's excluding and what it isn't. It's like, just trust us. We've done the right thing here. Let's move on.
I think in this particular case, and as Yara says, I'm most concerned with defending what the board has done in this case. And here, I think that it's sufficient if the court only looks at the evidence in the reply that was specifically recited by the board.
So you would just have us, you're almost making a harmless error argument, aren't you, that you would just have us assume that the board didn't consider, that what the board specifically talked about was proper consideration, and anything they didn't specifically talk about, they either didn't consider it all because it wasn't proper rebuttal, or it just doesn't matter.
That's
I don't really know how we can do that. Well, in this case, I mean, to the extent we agree with you that we can just ignore all that because what they did consider is sufficient, maybe that's your argument. But that seems a problem going forward for the board if they want to rely on evidence that wasn't specifically discussed, but still as part of the substantial evidence.
I think that's right, Your Honor, that if the board is not explicitly referencing the evidence that was submitted in rebuttal and it has just a general statement like this, that if it deemed it improper, it hasn't relied on it, I think you pretty much have to assume that they didn't rely on anything other than what they cited. But here we're only relying on, as substantial evidence to support the board's finding, the evidence in rebuttal. In fact, I think you can sustain the board's decision without looking at the rebuttal evidence at all, because really Quackenbush said that you can incorporate Fuller in two different ways. First is the general teaching of Fuller, that of use, the idea of using switching transmission rates. And as the board noted, there's no more detail than that in the 007 patent, just switching transmission rates. And that idea is disclosed by Fuller, and Quackenbush cites it for that idea. Quackenbush also references the specific application of that idea in Fuller, which is through the Java applets. Now,
and is it right that all of the contested evidence on reply, it has to do with the Java application implementation of the transmission rate?
That's right, Your Honor. So there was the one assertion was that that one of ordinary skill in the art would not have understood Fuller to have any application beyond Java. Now, that is contrary to Dr. Quackenbush's testimony in his opening affidavit, which is that one would have understood. Kind of, he starts with the general proposition and then talks about, as an example, the Java application. But he also says in his rebuttal declaration, but this is not any evidence, any further exhibits or anything. He simply says Java is a general programming language, and you can, if you can implement it with the Java general programming language, you can implement it with any other general programming language.
I realize that you've just made an argument that this motion to exclude ruling is really immaterial to the outcome here, but I guess I want to ask you about what's at least a sort of troubling procedural determination of two parts. One is, I think, what was already raised, namely where the board says, well, to the extent that we shouldn't have, we didn't, but we don't know what it is that that covers, and that leaves us in a quandary to know what they considered and what they didn't. But the other is this, I think, that relies maybe on something a board panel said in Liberty Mutual Liberty against Progressive, which I think was the last time we saw you, where it says, we will exclude evidence if it's inadmissible for hearsay or irrelevance, but we won't actually exclude it if it's improper because it's not rebuttal evidence. I don't really understand that. Can you enlighten me?
I read this opinion here as noting really that there are two different remedies. One is a very technical reading of a motion to exclude. A motion to exclude is you exclude evidence that is not proper evidence. It's not reliable. There are reasons that it's not admissible, right? And then there's a second question about whether the evidence should be struck in a sense. And they don't call it that, although this court in other cases, including Genzyme, has talked about a motion to strike improper reply evidence that goes beyond the scope of the opposition. And what I take the second sentence, the last sentence of that analysis to be, is to recognize that in an appropriate case, improper rebuttal evidence should be struck. And what the board is saying here is, I don't think they're determining that necessarily anything was improper, but what they have relied on in this final written decision is all proper rebuttal evidence. Because, again, the preliminary, the petition with Dr. Quackenbush's declaration made out the prima facie case, both at the level of Fuller's general teaching, but also at the level of the Java applet. And the patent owner came back, as they can be expected to try to undermine Quackenbush's testimony and have the board not credit it on the theory that Java wouldn't work on a handheld device. Well, they said that, but Dr. Quackenbush came back and said, well, no, here's a 1999 book about Java, which makes clear that there's not just general Java, but there's personal Java. And personal Java is designed to run applets, and it runs on devices that are more memory constrained, including a web phone or a handheld PC. These are the kinds of small personal devices that would do the kind of things that the 07 patent is claiming with respect to the streaming of the data. And so that's proper rebuttal evidence to say that Dr. Zhang, when he says these smaller devices can't run Java, that's wrong. He's ignoring personal Java, which was already out in 1999. And so that's proper rebuttal evidence, as is, and it wasn't evidence at all, I mean, in the form of like an exhibit, but his own statement in his declaration at paragraph 15, which the board does cite several times, that Java is simply a general purpose programming language. And so you can transfer that teaching to other languages. Okay. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Schultz, you've got 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will attempt to be quick. Just to address this last issue, the board made an arbitrary decision when it ignored the very regulations to allow new evidence in. The point that the court has raised and the question is, the PTAB regulations require that if there is any new evidence in the reply brief, the entire reply brief is gone. The regulations do not allow the board to do what they did here, which was to say, well, if there is new evidence, we won't consider that and we won't.
Really? Wait a minute. The rule is that if there's one sentence that relies on new evidence that's not rebuttal evidence, then we strike the entire reply?
That's correct, Your Honor. If you look at the Patent Office Patent Trial Guide at Federal Regulation page 48767.
Is that something that we have available in the material sitting on our desk right now?
I don't believe it is in there. I apologize for that, but it is obviously readily available on the Internet. But with that defines the practice guide, and it says in there, if there's new evidence in the reply, first it defines what new evidence is, which is if you need it for your prima facie case, that's new evidence. And if there's any new evidence in the reply brief, the whole brief is out. The board is not to sit there and parse what is new and what is not new. And it makes sense.
I don't understand. Isn't the definition of new based on if they get to respond to the patentee's submission, right? That's the whole point of a reply. So obviously they're not going to say exactly only the same thing they said originally, right? This is a reply brief.
Correct, Your Honor, and they fully get to do it. But if they need that evidence for their prima facie case, then that evidence should have been in the petition such that the patent owner would have the opportunity to respond to it, because if it's brought in the reply brief, it's sandbagging because the patent owner doesn't have any substantive response to it. So there's a public policy reason for it. And so just to briefly, quickly summarize here, all the evidence related to personal Java or the use of general programming language like Java, all that evidence that they need to show that the combination of Fuller would work was in the reply brief. If you look at the petition and the declaration of Dr. Quackenbush related to this element on using the Fuller Java applet in the petition, there is nothing there. Nothing. And so they need this evidence to establish not only the prima facie case, but their ultimate case should be stricken, should have been out, the board erred, and we'd expect reversal. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.